It's been almost 2 years since I released this podcast series examining the Kennedy assassination and the fallout over the years. Using my personal collection of interviews with key individuals I began speaking with in 2002. My goal was to present this in a fashion where I would not take any side. I wouldn't endorse the Oswald did it conclusion, and I wouldn't endorse any particular conspiracy theory, or if the assassination was the result of a conspiracy at all. But in the past 20 months, since my final episode dropped, a lot has happened to influence me to speak out from my perspective. This episode, A Changed Mind, will be split into two parts. Thoughts on some conspiratorial subject matter that I have dismissed entirely, as well as my thoughts on Lee Harvey Oswald's background and Jack Ruby's motives. Part two will examine everything else I want to address, from the presidential shooting itself and other key events that happened in Dallas and Washington on November 22, 1963. And before I get into it, anyone wanting to reach out to me, feel free. I'm at Eric J. Bushman on Twitter. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. As soon as my final episode, The Legacies, dropped, the emails, phone calls, texts, and social media messages began. The one question I kept getting over and over again was simply, so what do you think happened? Or maybe put, who do you think killed JFK? That one's easier for me to answer. I always make some comment like someone with a rifle in Dealey Plaza. Now, sometimes it's received with a laugh or an eye roll, but I've noticed if I don't answer it truthfully, I'm actually doing a disservice to the person asking. Let's go back in time. At the beginning, I shared with you that I got into this when I was 9 years old. That would be 1993, 2 years after Oliver Stone's JFK was released by Warner Brothers. So the movie was still fresh. I taped a TV-friendly version of the movie that was on cable. We had a rule in my house that we didn't watch rated R movies, so I figured out a way how to get that done. So I watched the movie JFK, and I watched it again, and I watched it some more, and it sucked me in, and all I wanted to do was read and watch more, only on conspiracies, because that is what was entertaining. I got through high school, I got into my 20s, and got a big boy job in journalism, and decided to shut my mouth on my opinion on the subject of the assassination. I still talked about the assassination, I just didn't publicly say what I think happened. That would be around 2003-2004. A very small number of the interviews I include in the podcast had been done by this point. I wanted to get serious in the news business, so I just shut my mouth on the subject publicly. I was, at the time, an admitted conspiracy believer, but some of the key players were already opening up to me. Detective Jim Lavelle of the Dallas Police Department being one of them. That interview was done in either 2001 or 2. Between 2004 and 2013, a great number of things happened. I met and interviewed former FBI agent Jim Hoste for a couple of hours. I was one of the last journalists to interview him before he died. I suspect I actually am the last, but I don't know. I can't prove it. He passed away about 6 months later. In 2012, I moved to Dallas to take a job at WBAP and KLIF, where I still am as of this year. This is when my relationship with Gary Mack evolved, the former curator of the sixth-floor museum at Dealey Plaza. I was also given the responsibility to handle pretty much all of the coverage for WBAP and KLIF for the 50th anniversary of the assassination in November 2013, a new series I put together, by the way, won an Edward R. Murrow Award. Now, this is when many of my interviews, long and short, took place. Then came the months before the 50th anniversary. There were a few private conversations I had with some of the people I interviewed. And I watched something that went in-depth into something horribly morbid, but it had to be morbid to prove a point on the conspiracy side that might be wrong. Simultaneously, I also discovered, quite by accident, that a series of photographs shown to me years before were not at all what the person showing them to me said they were. I discovered separately through a Dallas auction run by Heritage the exact same set of photos, but that is where I discovered their true meaning. This is where everything started to change. And I tell you, it changed for me rapidly. Maybe a week or two. There was some anger. There was some disappointment in myself as well. Then the 50th anniversary came. November 22nd, 2013, one of the longest days of my life. But then came November 23rd, 2013. And that is when I shut it all off. I wanted nothing to do with the assassination after that. I still, though, would go to Dealey Plaza on the anniversaries. Then came a road trip I took in late 2019, and I thought to myself, I'll just listen to all my interviews. It took hours, but I got through them. Made notes, began pulling the cuts, and decided to tell the story through my personal collection plus some historic audio to add context. And that was the 10-episode podcast that precedes this bonus episode. But I'm ready to finally give you my opinion. Who killed President John F. Kennedy is researched and thought out by me, Eric Bushman, who spoke with all these people, read a bunch of stuff, watched a bunch of stuff, and just doesn't want to sleep on it anymore. You know how I mentioned I was BS'd by those pictures as an example? Well, I want to give you a couple of examples of what I consider absolute pure crap, and I've heard it outlined too many times by too many people in too many places. There's a reason I want to spend some time on it, and it's just, these are just two subjects that irritate me. And the first one I want to talk about is, quote unquote, they changed the motorcade route. The movie JFK goes into this pretty hard a few times, and for the life of me, I have never understood why researchers waste time on this. The argument is this. There's a planned assassination of President Kennedy. There's a fall guy, Lee Harvey Oswald. Other people connected with whatever agency within the U.S. government are in control of the situation. The original route, the argument continues, would take the motorcade to Dealey Plaza, but it would continue straight down Main Street, which is a central street between Elm and Commerce that runs east-west through Dealey Plaza between Houston Street and the Triple Railroad Underpass. These professional riflemen, the story goes, can't hit a target just a half a block farther away. And that's really all it is. Elm, Main, and Commerce are about a block apart from each other, but Elm and Commerce curve toward one another. And all three are connected by the time you hit the underpass. It's just one huge street on the other side. My point is to say someone is a professional rifleman, but that person can't hit a target just a few more yards over? Well, that doesn't sound too professional to me. The motorcade route took JFK onto Stemmons Freeway. Today is I-35E, and that would go from Dealey Plaza out of downtown Dallas up the highway to the Industrial Boulevard exit, which today is Market Center Boulevard. Then they would pull into the Dallas Trademark for the luncheon. So if the motorcade route was changed, to me, it's about as simple as knowing one fact that this bogus argument completely ignores. You can't get to the highway from Main Street. The entire cavalcade of vehicles would have to hop a curb still separating Main and Elm on the west side of the underpass. So you can only get to it from Elm. The motorcade had to turn onto Houston Street in order to go down Elm Street, which is where the assassination took place. Had the route gone down Main, the only option would have been to turn right onto what is today Riverfront, which turns in to Market Center Boulevard. Back in the day, that whole stretch was called Industrial Boulevard. So that's a way to get there. But those who drew up the motorcade chose the highway. Any route change, even if it changed at all, changed for that reason. Not to intentionally slow the motorcade or bring it closer by just a few yards to the book depository or the grassy knoll. In this subject, just like in politics, there are distractions. But it does make for a good movie, I'll give you that. Just like in the movie when someone makes a comment about the Warren Commission not having an index. Well, hey, Buster, why don't you just grab a copy of the report and check out the last 8 pages? That's the index. My last bogus argument I'd like to put to bed. Why didn't Oswald, or anyone for that matter, shoot the president on Houston Street? This is one of those arguments put forward by those who believe Lee Harvey Oswald didn't act alone, and it's the fact that no shots were fired at the president when he was traveling on Houston between Main and Elm. The argument is that with someone positioned in the area of the grassy knoll waiting to shoot the president on Elm means there's a triangulated crossfire. The limousine is surrounded by the shooters, so it had nowhere to go but through the path of at least one gunman while still in the path of those behind it. Standing in the windows of the Texas School Book Depository that looks south, facing Dealey Plaza, anything approaching north on Houston would be slowing down to make the turn onto Elm, and getting bigger in the scope of the rifle. It's a good argument, and it makes a lot of sense. But there's another point to this scenario that's left out completely. To shoot at the car coming up Houston, you would be completely exposed. Everyone could look up and see you. It would be easier for Secret Service and Dallas police to look up, identify the rifle, pull their guns, and return fire. Oswald or anyone up there would be aware of the view out the window. Plus, when officers found the sniper's nest, it was encased in stacks of boxes. So whoever was in that window at the time of the assassination was already concealing himself inside, hiding from anyone else who might have been on the floor at the time. So it would make sense that person would want to hide from those outside looking up and the guards charged with protecting the president. Waiting to shoot on Elm makes more sense, given the shooter's desire to shield himself. He could hide behind the wall of the building with only the barrel of the rifle sticking out of the window. Plus, with the curved manner of Elm Street looking down through the window, a gunman would only have to raise the gun up a few degrees as a car traveled farther down the street before curving back the other way headed into the underpass. Plus, here's a question. Did Oswald or anyone in the window know exactly where to find the president in the motorcade? Which car would he be in? Where would he be seated? Maybe it took a few seconds while the limousine was getting closer to the building and slowing to make that turn. Now let's talk about Lee Harvey Oswald. Lee Harvey Oswald accomplished many things. He was a Marine. He scored high above average on many of his tests in the Marines. And those he served with say he followed orders, even though he was court-martialed twice. In Atsugi, Japan, it was his job to use radar for the American aircraft to intercept Russian or Chinese aircraft. His interests took him abroad. After the Marines, he was able to go to Russia. Not exactly something easy to do in 1959, but he did it. But why did he go to Russia? Did he renounce his U.S. citizenship voluntarily, or because someone or something forced him to? Or was it his job to do it like a fake defector, keeping in mind his military background? The Russians saw fit to give him money, but told him he had to go to Minsk and live and work there. While working at the factory, his salary was considered high compared to other professions, and he was still being given money by the Russian government. Why on earth was this? Then it gets even more interesting. He meets a woman and marries her, and wants to leave with what he built in Russia, come back to the United States, from which we are told he voluntarily fled after leaving the Marines, and like any newlywed, asked the U.S. government permission to bring his Russian wife and child. And sure enough, he's allowed to return, and his wife is given an American visa. And at the American Embassy in Moscow, he is given what is called a repatriation loan to travel back. Again, being given money, but this time by the State Department of the United States. How exactly does that work? This is certainly not a simple guy. There is something mysterious about Lee Harvey Oswald, and many things I don't think we are ever going to know. I want to jump ahead now and talk about Jack Ruby. One thing we need to discuss, even though it does not have any direct impact to Oswald's guilt, is Jack Ruby. This is one of those areas where the conspiracy people use that Ruby's role was to shut Oswald up, either that Oswald was a part of something larger or that he knew he was set up for something he had nothing to do with. Where was Ruby, though, prior to the attempted move of prisoner Oswald from the Dallas City Jail to the Dallas County Jail 2 days after the assassination? He was across and up the street on Main, at the Western Union office, wiring money to one of his employees, a stripper who danced at the Carousel Club. The timestamp on the receipt of the money transfer was 11:17 a.m. At that exact time, Oswald was being given the final preparations following one final interview in the Dallas Police Headquarters. He was shot by Ruby 4 minutes later. During this 4 minute period, Ruby walked from the Western Union office a few yards and across Main Street and into the police headquarters. This should come as no surprise. Ruby was in the police building frequently, and he was even shown on television being there during a press conference that weekend. Whether he saw the crowd, knew of the transfer, or something else got his attention, no one should be surprised he decided to drop by. Keep in mind, he left his dog Sheba in the car parked at the Western Union office. Now, while Ruby wouldn't say immediately afterward, he eventually admitted that he walked down the Main Street ramp at the same time an officer was driving his vehicle down the ramp, so he may not have been seen by officers guarding the ramp. Plus, even if an officer had seen him, perhaps they didn't care, given the fact that Ruby was in the building and around the scene of action quite frequently. The night before, Dallas police had indicated to the press that the transfer would happen the following morning. The only specific time given was a generic time, saying if they were there by 10 o'clock, they wouldn't miss anything. That didn't mean the transfer would happen at 10 o'clock, just that it wouldn't happen before then. So if Ruby's goal in some elaborate conspiracy was to take out the prisoner for whatever purpose, why on earth did he sleep late, leave his Oak Cliff apartment, and meander his way over to the Western Union office? He wasn't in the basement that morning until after the money transfer. This is a total and highly unfortunate coincidence that he got in the basement right before Oswald was brought out. Oswald was being interrogated again that morning up until about 11:15. It's not as if there was some magic signal that Hitman Ruby was in the building so Oswald could be brought out. Even Ruby's own lawyers argued that Ruby was suffering from some sort of mental episode at the moment he jumped forward to shoot Oswald. Ruby later claimed he didn't want Jackie Kennedy to have to testify at a trial of Oswald, even though there was absolutely no outside discussion that would happen. Jack Ruby was not a part of any organized conspiracy to do anything. He was a man who craved attention and sucked up to cops and reporters. He gave his card out to reporters in the aftermath of the assassination. This was a man who had an opportunity to become a hero in his own mind and made a split-second decision that screwed everything up. Now let's talk about Lee Harvey Oswald's trip to Mexico City. This is one of those areas where you just have to ask yourself if you trust the initial investigation. FBI agent Jim Hostie knew about this trip before the assassination because he asked Oswald in police custody immediately following the assassination. It was apparently on the FBI's radar, however, not alarming enough to do anything that could have prevented the assassination. The simple question here is, do I believe this trip happened? And absolutely, I do. There's travel documents, witness testimony, and multiple identifications while Oswald was there. But what were the conversations like? It is interesting to note that the Cuban and Soviet embassies in Mexico City, while in different buildings, are within the same compound, so it wasn't as if someone had to do a lot of traveling within the city. Did Oswald really tell KGB agent Valery Kostikov that he could kill President Kennedy in order to get into Cuba or the Soviet Union? Or did he simply desperately try to get into Cuba or the Soviet Union and no threats were ever made to Kennedy? Hell, I don't know. I could imagine what a defense attorney might argue in court if Oswald lived to stand trial. Ask any member of the jury to consider if they had been to Mexico City or anywhere where there might be an embassy of an adversary or enemy, and if they would have gone to those embassies, does that mean you threatened to kill the President of the United States? Let's say, for argument, that Oswald did, in a rage or an act of desperation, make the threat to Kennedy's life while in the embassy, in front of KGB agent Kostikov. The whole concept is still backwards to me. If he volunteered that he would commit such an act in hopes of being granted residency in Cuba or the Soviet Union, he had no clue at the time that President Kennedy's Dallas motorcade would travel right next to a building that he did not work at yet. Plus, it's not as if it was known that President Kennedy's motorcade would travel by the book depository when Oswald applied to work there. Also keep in mind, Oswald only applied to work at the depository after it was suggested to him by someone who was aware of an opening. Everything happens in the opposite order. FBI agent Hostie says an informant claims Oswald volunteered to kill the president and they kicked him out of the embassy. Then Oswald randomly gets a job at the book depository. Then the motorcade route is published. But there is another way to look at this, if Oswald made the threats. By complete coincidence, he got an opportunity to carry out the threat when he found out the motorcade would come by. In the second part of this episode, A Changed Mind, I will go into detail on exactly how I believe the shooting sequence went down. Number of shots, direction, timing, etc. Also, I'll give my take on Lee Harvey Oswald's actions following the shooting. The differences between what the Dallas doctors at Parkland Hospital did compared to those who conducted the autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and the shooting of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit, and how FBI agent Jim Hostie's claim about a CIA investigation that was eventually ordered to be dropped might have ties to why Oswald would have been in the area of Oak Cliff in Dallas when he was stopped by Officer Tippit. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas.